And a very good morning to everyone in the studio and to our listeners.
Morning.
Good morning, Steph.
Good morning, Steph.
Happy, happy Friday.
Yeah.
Hasn't it felt like a long week? Or am I the only one?
You're the only one. It feels like yesterday that we were doing this.
Well,
last
the good
week.
Stuff starts now.
Certainly right in the thick of the year. It feels like we're in the thick of the year now, that's for sure.
Christmas well underway.
Is well and truly over.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Easter will be here before we know it.
Yeah. Are you guys going away for Easter? Doing anything fun?
Yeah, planning an overseas holiday, actually.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Where to?
New Zealand.
Oh, unreal. Oh,
yeah.
New Zealand's good stuff.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Yeah. How did your camping trip go the other day?
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Camping's a lot of fun. Yeah. It's a long drive to go for one night, but even then it's still fun just being out in the bush and unplugging for a little bit.
Yeah.
Whereabouts was that again?
We were somewhere most of the way to Eildon.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Somewhere.
And did you actually not use your mobile phone?
Correct.
Wow. That's impressive.
For about
4 hours of the evening and 4 hours of the next morning. Yeah. The phone was somewhere in the tent.
Yeah.
I think it was still on. Oh, no, I was out of reception range. Yeah.
That's even better.
Yep.
Well, I didn't
have no choice.
I didn't use mine for about 8 hours last night. Between about 11 and...
It's funny, it really is a habit, isn't it? Just to grab your phone and just check 20 times throughout the night, even when you're having dinner and after dinner.
Yeah.
And
it's
really not a good thing.
Yep, absolutely.
Joel knows all about that.
Do I?
Can't put his phone down.
I'm usually checking sports scores or something like that.
Yeah. Important stuff.
Yeah, who's in the Collingwood team? Who's
exactly.
Out?
Not the stock market.
All starts tonight.
Yes, it does.
There's actually a couple of guys out of Silicon Valley, former app and web developers for Google and YouTube and other apps, who are all about now how to minimize the disruption of your phones and in your life in general. So they've come from the peak distraction to actually, now that we've built these apps and we know how distracting and disruptive they are, what are the things you can do with your phone to make them less disruptive to your life?
And I'm sure that's making them money somehow.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yep. They've written a book about it. I'm sure.
Good old capitalism.
Yeah. Have you read it?
I have been reading it. On audiobook, it's a bit heavy when it's tip after tip and just a checklist of things. But they've written a very good article, which is worth sharing, which is all kinds of things you can do to make your phone less addictive. Like you'll see on my phone, it's got a black screen. Is that every time you pick it up, you're visually stimulated slightly less.
Okay.
It's not a bright screen. It's not a picture that makes me go, oh, wonderful. So it's not as much of an emotional response every time I pick up my phone.
So true. Even the big apps like Instagram, I notice you can put a timer on how much time you're spending online, which is good.
Well, they kick you off, can they?
Well, I don't know if they kick you off, but you set your own rules. Yeah,
that's helpful.
Yeah. Anyway, we better kick into our full podcast today, and we'll start with Joel. You're going to discuss the Federal Reserve and the future of financial advice. Tell us some more.
Yes. Well, this week we had the Federal Reserve come out with their Open Market Committee announcement. So the Federal Open Market Committee meets once a month throughout the course of the year and announce their interest rate setting policy, which is important for us as investors because the US Federal Reserve is the most powerful central bank in the world. Most of the world's interest rates are set off what the US Federal Reserve's, policy settings are. So, if you're looking at mortgages here in Australia, a large proportion of the funding costs that make up our banks comes from funds that they get overseas, and those funds overseas are priced off what the Federal Reserve sets.
There was about a decade where whenever the Fed moved its rates in the US, the next month, the RBA in Australia would move it exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it also has an impact for that segment of funding that the banks receive from overseas that isn't actually tied into what the Reserve Bank does as well. So, obviously if they're borrowing money from overseas institutions, they're borrowing money from overseas banks and pension funds to fund their mortgage book, the cost of funds overseas is tied into what the Federal Reserve actually states regarding their policy. And the Fed has just completely gone backflipped on their position where they were prior to Christmas time. And, so Federal Reserve Chairman Powell, he announced in December that the Fed was expecting to not only raise rates at that December meeting, which they did by 0.25% to 2.5%, that they're also going to raise rates another two times this calendar year. Obviously, with the recent turmoil that's taking place, the slowing down in global economic growth, they've completely removed any indication that they're going to raise rates going forward for this financial year or this calendar year. And not only that, they're also going to cease their bond buying program, or the reduction of their balance sheet, which is basically cash that they've put into the economy to support the economy back in the global financial crisis times. They were hoping to shrink that amount of cash and take that liquidity out of the system, but that's no longer possible for them either. So this is like a complete about face in the space of about 3 months. Wow. And we've spoken about this a couple of times throughout the course of the last couple of weeks in regards to what the hell were they doing back in December? What were they looking at in December? The market was telling them. They created this huge sell-off and volatility just before Christmas time, only to, you know, 2 months later on, completely get to where the market was telling them they should have been in the first place. So, look.
What's your thoughts on it? What was going on?
Well, they just were ignoring the news. I think, and this is the problem that the Fed has had historically. They're not good at looking forward, and they're not good at assessing what is actually happening right now. They tend to be too dependent on the data that was lagging to make their policy decisions. Mm-hmm. So when Jerome Powell was going into the Federal Reserve announcement in December, he was looking at GDP growth historically in the US. He was looking at, you know, inflation rates historically in the US that had just happened over the past 6 to 9 months. He was looking at wages growth that had been taken place over the last 6 to 9 months in the US. And he was basing his decision based on that, but he wasn't looking at some of the leading economic indicators that if you just looked, like the IMS manufacturing index, if you had a look at some of the leading indexes for manufacturing overseas, China, Europe, they were all starting to decline. And they're all starting to show that there was, you know, definitely a slowdown that was taking place. And what the Fed seemed to have forgotten is that they had raised interest rates three times already leading into December. The fourth time was in December when they raised. But those interest rate increases take anywhere up to 12 to 18 months to actually filter through the economy by the time that it actually gets repriced through the economy. So what he was seeing in December wasn't even taking into account the previous three interest rate increases that had taken place prior to then. So, and this is why the Fed creates these boom-bust cycles, and central banks tend to create these boom-bust cycles, because whatever they're looking at, they just don't seem to be looking at the right stuff. And they just don't seem to be taking into account these leading economic indicators enough. They seem to be wasting too much time on the lagging data that is outdated.
So how do they set their process? I mean, is it just archaic that they just stick with what they've always done, or
this is another perhaps, you know, criticism of the Fed is that, you know, a lot of these people making these decisions, they're academics. Yeah. They're not real world people. They live in their little, you know, theoretical formula based world, and they've never run businesses. They've never actually had a private sector job in their life. And if they have, it's because they're a consultant, because they're a professor at Harvard or Princeton or wherever it may have been. So they don't have any real general concept of what actually goes on in the real world. So they don't know, they don't tend to have a good, you know, just
A feel for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they use these models, and these models are inherently terrible at predicting the future. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen a clip back in the early 2000s when the previous Federal Reserve chair, Greenspan, and I think it was Barney Frank, and he was up in front of Congress, providing testimony to Congress, which they do every 6 months, just in, you know, how are things going. I think Barney Frank was getting stuck into Greenspan saying, do you realize that every forecast that you've ever put out has been wrong? And yet you've been in this job for the last 23 years, and I don't know anyone who would be running a business or
running a corporation
who would still have their job if they were as wrong as what you have
been.
But wow. I think the thing is that it's more ridiculous that he was still in a job.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So is it fair to say that these people that are in probably the most powerful position regarding the economy are not the smartest of all the people that could have impact?
Yeah.
I think that's true for business generally. Like, a lot of the time you actually have people in management positions and you think,
A lot of the time, I think saying the person is not smart enough is maybe not quite the right response. I would suggest it's probably the system that's not quite good enough.
Correct.
So knowing what other economists and business forecasters use, and if I think of Ray Dalio's book Principles and the way that they design their decision-making process, that is the most beautiful decision-making process you could ever imagine, combining human experience and human decisions, but also supported by algorithms and data-based decisions, and then using a system and a process to match the two together to help you to make an informed decision. So the humans say, well, what is the algorithm telling us and why? And maybe that's better in some ways. But then from the algorithm's point of view, well, what are the humans telling us and what's missing from the algorithm?
I think what Joel said, though, is people tend to get stuck. They've done it that way for so long and you just continue. It's just a cycle with a lot of businesses where they just go, well, that's the way we've always done it, so we're just going to continue.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe and the Fed should engage Ray Dalio.
Oh, they probably should, yeah.
I'm sure Ray Dalio would like to engage with the Fed.
I'm sure. The thing is, if you're a successful hedge fund manager or investor of any kind, your paycheck is going to be millions,
billions,
tens of millions, hundreds of millions per year,
and
the Fed is not paying salaries
Maybe
of that.
The Fed should just get a copy of the book. Might just save them.
Yeah, but you got to understand, these guys have got tenure at these universities, right? And their whole career is based on these formulas and theories that have been espoused that they're using to make these decisions, which continually get proven to be just not real world models.
But still they continue.
Yep. What do they say? The definition of insanity. Keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Anyway, that's my little rant for the week. There's one other thing that I thought was interesting. Westpac this week has announced that they're getting out of the personal financial advice industry by selling off their financial advice business to a company called Viridian. That's completely separating that from Westpac. And Brian Hartz, the CEO, has perhaps given the clearest indication of what a post-Royal Commission financial advice world is going to look like. And quite clearly what he has said is that the cost of regulation and the cost of providing personal financial advice is just skyrocketing at the moment. And this is as a result of insurance commission reforms, of future financial advice reforms, and obviously reforms that are coming through off the back of the Royal Commission. And basically what he has said, and I got to tend to agree with him, is that you're going to get this situation where essentially the only people who are going to get and can afford personal financial advice are going to be those that are more wealthier with more assets that can actually afford that bespoke level of advice. And that unfortunately the ones who actually need it the most, the ones who need help with budgeting and cash flows and savings plans and you know having that higher touch, that's now going to be something of a general advice service that they're going to get. No personal advice. It's going to go back to the old days of product flogging because people can't actually, or robo-advice.
That's what I was going to ask about the robo-advice because, yes, you're probably right, it's going to cost too much money, but as robo-advice becomes more and more prevalent, can't people just jump online and help themselves?
I would like to see what the robo-advice world actually looks like because we've had this debate about risk profiling clients. Mm. And there's this old notion that, okay, an aggressive investor will have more growth assets, a more conservative investor will have less growth assets. But a lot of the time, what investors actually need is education and guidance, because as soon as we spend some time with those clients and educating them and guiding them on what is actually risk and how you manage risk, before you know it, we're taking conservative investors and they're becoming aggressive investors, or not aggressive investors, but more growth orientated investors, just pure and simply because it was just ignorance around, you know, what they should be doing and how they should be feeling about certain risks. And that, it creates a problem in my mind, because I think a lot of these robo-advice algorithms are really still plugging into that old model of, okay, if you're a conservative investor, this is your profile and this is the investment allocation that you're going to be given off the back of that, which is probably going to, you know, shave 2-4% off a client's long-term annual compounded rate of return, simply because all they needed was just more education, not being plugged into a predefined model of, you know, what their risk tolerance is.
The way I see robo-advice is for someone who has $100,000 or $200,000 to invest and is adding more through savings, then the robo-advice can say, well, let's go through a questionnaire and I'll put you into some investments which are recommended through their algorithm based on the questionnaire that you follow. The question for me is, what about the people who don't have the $100,000 or $200,000 to invest? And that's where robo-advice can't help.
It can't help, but then it couldn't help somebody to come to a financial advisor in the first place, because it's far too expensive for somebody that has less than $100,000.
Well,
there were solutions to that, though, under the old model. Unfortunately, see, what was happening was that, and it wasn't a perfect model previously either, but I'm just sort of saying, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't in some regards. But those types of lower value clients were still relatively profitable for the banks to deal with, because of the ability to cross-sell different products and get clients into, you know, their own products.
Yeah, but that's frightening as well. They're just selling on the product.
And I'm not saying that was the right model either, but there are, you know, always unintended consequences when we move away from one model to another. And I think that one of the dangers here with robo-advice is that you're going to be, this algorithm could potentially be putting people who need to be more growth focused
into the wrong category,
into a more conservative approach, pure and simply because they're not getting the education that probably would have moved them into a more growth focused portfolio.
And they're answering questions without really the context around
exactly. So, you know, you've got this questionnaire, and all of a sudden this questionnaire is being put in front of them, but yet they've got no context in how to really sort of answer that in a way that's going to be beneficial for them. So they just plug them into this model, give them this conservative portfolio. They're going to get 6% instead of 10%, and that could have a devastating impact on their long-term wealth if you're doing that for 10 years, 20 years.
Well, when an advisor's asking questions, they can interpret by body language and the way a person's reacting to whether they've understood the question. On a computer, that's not possible.
Yep, all sorts of things. The other thing for me is, coming back to the people who need advice that can't afford it, something I love to do as a financial planner, and I haven't met any financial planner that doesn't love to do this, is meet a person for free for the first time and give them help. So someone who needs that basic cash flow advice, I don't know it at the time that they walk into my office, but then I help them in that meeting as best as I can. And because we are a small business, there is a good amount of those clients who return to us. I think there's a bit of loyalty when a consumer meets with us as a small business. They will come back. The problem the banks have is, if a person meets them and gets free or low-cost advice, because they're coming to a big brand, there's not that loyalty. So I don't think your big brands can afford to have a low-cost service on the assumption that people will come back, because they won't come back. The financial planner that probably helped them first is probably not there anymore or has moved on to something else. Whereas a small business like ours, you can see someone this year, and then we can wait 2 years, 3 years for that person to come back. And because that person met us and we're a small business and there's a relationship there, they're more likely to come back to us.
Well, let's hope that this actually, you know, promotes smaller businesses and that people do come seeking advice instead of going to a larger firm and you know, just getting general advice given to them.
So if you're broke, come and see me.
But it's, I mean, that is good to know that you can just come and have you know, a session with you and just get a general sense of what I should be doing before I can have to commit to a full service. So,
yep. If you want a really good session, take me out for lunch.
That's good. I'm sure they'd come back.
Geez, you're cheap.
You don't know where they have to take me.
Very good.
All right. Well, look, we're going to head to a short break now and we'll be back after this short message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, and welcome back, guys. We're now going to move on to Brett, who's going to talk about the RBA telling the banks to lend.
Yep, exactly right, Steph. So recently, the RBA Assistant Governor, Michelle Bullock, was speaking at an event for property developers just this week. And basically, the point of it was saying that the banks have to start loosening the reins and let purchasers, people wanting to buy residential property, start to lend, make it easier for them and you know, take off all of the handbrakes they've put on of the last few months. Now, a big part of the reason for why she said that, and I'll quote from a couple of articles here. So she's actually saying that it's possible that tighter lending standards could be impacting developers of apartments. This could be directly by banks not actually lending to the developers to actually build, but more likely it's indirectly because they're tightening their lending standards for purchasers and hence impacting pre-sales for developers and their ability to obtain finance. Mm. She's gone on to say that the impact of this is actually quite severe for the economy, potentially. So she says, from a financial stability perspective, prudent lending standards are a good thing, ensuring households and banks are resilient to changes in circumstances, but there needs to be a balance. So the regulators aren't proposing any further tightening in lending standards, and the appropriate amount of credit risk is not zero, but banks need to continue to lend.
Brett, do you think we've gone too far with tightening up?
I think we have. Not so much that we're not putting the right things in place, but the biggest issue I've seen, especially in the last few months, is the time it's taking for loans to get approved.
Okay.
Banks are lending, but what used to be, say, a 2 to 3 week time frame to get an approval is now turning into 2 months.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's having a flow-on effect, and it's costing everyone. Like, purchasers that have signed a contract, if that settlement date's missed because the finance isn't approved in time, it's costing them. You know, probably the only people that are winning are potentially lawyers or conveyancers or whoever's charging the extra fee, and maybe vendors. But then again, vendors may have already purchased elsewhere and they're needing their sale to settle.
Correct.
Yep. So, yeah, I think we just need to, obviously, it's going to take a while for all this to wash through, but we do need to have the banks start to go back to the processes they had a year or two ago and be lending on better terms. And
another question, though, you just mentioned in that report that developers need funds to actually do more, you know, apartments. Do we need more apartments?
Well, that's a tough one to say. I mean, population growth and, you know, supply and demand.
It might not necessarily be just apartments, though, either. It could be land, house and land packages, those types of things.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to dissect this article into the specific parts, but she does indicate that there's a flow-on effect. If the banks aren't lending to the purchasers of apartments and the developers aren't getting their funds for apartments, well, ultimately it does impact the whole residential market.
Right.
Because as values go down there, people are likely to say, oh, well, maybe we'll buy a cheaper apartment rather than a house because it makes better financial sense. And then maybe the flow-on effect is that housing prices start to drop.
Mm. I'm seeing it the other way around, because surely that would impact the supply of new stock coming onto the market, which would lead to a shortage in future. Wouldn't that be upwards pressure on prices?
Look, there's another part to this that I think is probably missed in this article and not really considered, is probably the biggest employer in the country is the construction industry.
Of course.
And
huge.
If these developers are not able to develop and therefore not able to build and not engage builders, then there's a lot of jobs that go missing. therefore the economy is impacted more so. Yeah. So it's not just about house prices. This shows how it's all
interconnected.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can have an effect more on the margin, right? So those developments that would have been, those last 5 or 10% of projects that would have got out of the ground, they're no longer getting out of the ground, and you know, the overtime that was being, earned by construction workers because there was a lot of projects going on at the time, they're no longer earning that overtime.
Mm.
And then obviously, that reduces buying power by consumers and by those workers.
I mean, if you think of the number of 5%, if 5% of projects don't go ahead, you think, oh, whatever.
Mm.
But then you think of, well, hang on, what if that sector loses 5% of its jobs?
Yeah. Mm.
And you're thinking, oh, well, actually, yeah, that's a huge impact.
Mm-hmm. And think about the fact that, on average, Australian households are only saving about 2 or 3% of their income.
That's right.
So all of a sudden, if you're seeing, wages impacted by 10%, because at the margin, you're not getting the overtime, you're not getting that extra job being built, that has a flow-on effect. And that's why we're probably seeing this, almost certainly why we're seeing this softening in the Australian economy right now.
Yeah. And look, one other part of it as well, the issue for the developers, if they're not being able to get their sales through, so the banks aren't lending to the end purchasers, whether that's pre-sales or completed stock, they're left holding a lot more stock at the end of a project, and they're obviously...
And a hell of a lot of debt.
And potentially a hell of a lot of debt. Mm. Even if they can get rid of the debt, they don't have the capital to go again.
Yeah.
No.
So that's where, it has a knock-on effect as well.
Yep.
Mm. So, yeah, it is all linked. Now, the last part of the article that I thought was worth mentioning is that they mentioned that household debt-to-income ratios, I wasn't aware of how drastic the change has been. They were at around 70% at the beginning of the 1990s, rose to around 160% at the time of the GFC. Right now, it's at around 190%.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, so... That's significant. Obviously, interest rates are a big factor in that. They're significantly lower than they have been previously.
Yeah, so housing affordability, I don't think, is out historically all that much. But yes, the amount of debt each household now has, has skyrocketed, obviously, because debt's cheaper today than what it was previously.
Yeah, so if those interest rates were to increase by a percent or two, that's really going to hurt a lot of people.
Yeah.
And this probably ties back into some of the concerns that some economists were having with regards to interest rates potentially rising going forward. Well, the Fed has now said that they're not going to be raising interest rates. Europe is now re-stimulating by doing quantitative easing again. There's a good chance that interest rates aren't going up anywhere in the world, probably for an extended period of time. In fact, remember, Australia hasn't had an interest rate increase for almost 2 years, I don't think. Yeah. It might even be a bit longer than that.
Yep.
There's every chance now that the Fed is probably not going to raise interest rates for an extended period of time. So we might just find that we're in this plateau now, where we've got too much debt to go and continue to take on more debt. We've got, housing affordability is not at, dangerous levels, but it's certainly not at levels that it's going to see, a significant amount of growth.
Mm. So people sitting in cash should start investing in property? Good time?
Look, property, again, we always come back to our simple principles. Markets, get the right property at the right time, in the right way.
But it should be a fairly good time to be looking if definitely interest rates are, on hold and the market's starting to slide a bit.
All the market data is still saying that residential property's in decline across the country.
Yeah.
But the forecasts are that it's not going to decline much more than where it's gone to. Like the bulk of the declines have been suggested to be... have already happened.
Exactly. And once again, let's not forget that it's a market of properties, not a property market.
Correct.
Right? And there are always opportunities. There's always a bull market somewhere. And our job as professional investors is to identify where those opportunities are and actively work to get our investors positioned into those opportunities.
Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, we're going to take another short break and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, and welcome back, guys. We're now going to throw over to Louis. And Louis, you're going to tell us about a book that you've been reading.
Absolutely. Very interesting. I take it most people will have seen the movie Catch Me If You Can.
Great movie.
That great movie. I'm reading the book all about the life and times of Frank Abagnale Jr.
Right. He was a fraud.
He was a fraud.
A smart one.
Con man. Very, very smart man. Like, or should I say very smart boy.
Right.
Because he made all of his crimes and his adventures all before the age of 20.
Really?
He was 20 years old when he was finally arrested and captured in France.
20? Really?
20 years old. He started his cheque swindling. He left home when I think he was 16 years old.
Yeah.
And started his cheque swindling on the streets of New York.
You sure this is
in 4 years he did that.
That's impressive.
Yep, that's right.
You sure we're not talking about Greenspan here?
And all he did was work out how to take something real and create a copy of it. That's pretty much his scam.
Yeah.
So, okay, here's something
I'm convinced we're talking about Greenspan. Taking real money, create copies of it, flood the economy.
That's right, So here's a legitimate check, okay? Let's make a fake check, or let's make a copy of it, or let's use a legitimate check that's actually not any good, and let's pass it off and see who will give me money in return for that check, as was the system at that time.
Yeah.
And he just worked out better and better ways to pass bigger and bigger checks
that
more often that people would
accept
in ways that utilized the banking systems and the people's the bank employees' lack of knowledge of their own system and the checks and balances that were in place.
So he was a pioneer.
He was a pioneer, that's right. It's one way to look at it. So he exploited systems, but he also he didn't exploit people, but he had to dupe people in order to exploit the system. And in a few points of the book, he does talk about his values system, if you can call it that. It was fairly bent, but he would always rip off only institutions. He would never pass a bad check to someone in a retail store, to a small business owner, or to a person in a big retail organization who was working on commissions.
So he's an ethical fraud.
Ethical.
He's a real Robin Hood.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Kind of like him.
He never wanted the person that he was duping to suffer an impact from his fraud.
Right.
So he didn't want to buy a suit with a fraudulent check and then have that salesperson have
it.
The cost of the suit deducted from their wages.
Yeah, right.
So he would always pay cash, good money for his actual expenses. The thing that he did was he was able to extract the money from organisations.
Mm-hmm. What happened to him? Because I can't remember the film. I can't remember what happens in the end.
In the book, I'm only as far as him being in prison in France in horrible conditions.
Yeah.
If I recall the movie, he goes to prison in Europe. He is extradited to the USA where he serves more prison time, but then is actually engaged by the FBI to help them with other fraudulent check claims, and he's an expert in his field. But I'll tell you more about the book once I get to the end of it.
Yeah.
But here's what it got me thinking of. It's the situation where something looks one way but is actually the other. And where have we been experiencing this recently? Well, I'll come back to the Royal Commission. And one of the recommendations from Commissioner Hayne is that the trustees of superannuation funds, the people on those boards, should not also have responsibilities elsewhere. It's recommendation 3.1 for the trustee of a responsible entity should be prohibited from assuming obligations from another entity. I'm paraphrasing and summarising, but what it means is for the people who are supposed to be acting in the superannuation interest. Fund members' best interests, they are conflicted if they are also trying to serve the organisation's profit levels.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. If you're on the board of a company that's maximising profits, you're obligated to try and maximise shareholder returns. That's the law. If you're on a trustee of a super fund, you're obligated to act in the best interest of your members. And the issue has been that Commissioner Hayne has highlighted is there's people who have both roles. And those are conflicting roles. How can you maximise shareholder profits on one side while that involves charging fees to another entity where you're supposed to be trying to minimise the fees.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that it's taken this long to actually have it change in the first place, because it's a fairly logical recommendation, isn't
it? That's right, exactly. So why does that remind me of the fraud of cheque swindling and con artistry?
Yeah.
It reminds me because you have superannuation funds that look like big brands. They look successful. They've got beautiful logos.
Great advertising.
Great advertising that talks about returns.
Yeah.
Compare the
and
pair.
doing better with your super. But when you look at the actual results, it's just not there. And it's not that far off saying, here's the money, but they're not actually fronting up with it.
Yeah,
so you got those conflicts that have happened with AMP, IOOF, even your precious industry superannuation funds.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the conflict there? Well, these industry superannuation funds were set up by unions, and the unions have a vested interest in being able to fund their...
Projects,
exactly, shall we say. And one of the issues that popped up with Industry Super is that a lot of the trustees of these responsible entities, or a lot of the members of these responsible entities overseeing the super funds, were also members of the Industry Super Property Trust, which is the one that's doing a lot of these construction jobs, keeping their members in power. So there's this exertion and influence that comes from the unions, because the unions are funneling money from members into projects that keep them in a job, which, you know, creates a stronger union base, which allows for political influence as well.
So the thing about that, and I think the reason why that's escaped the harsh scrutiny of the Royal Commission, is because it's not a straightforward financial conflict.
Sure.
Because the union is not a money-making entity. Political influence is not arguably on the surface of it. Yes, as long as we're keeping everything above the table, political influence is not a profit-making entity. Again, if you're keeping things above the table, and you know, we know how society works on the dark side, whereas it is a clear conflict with the retail super funds. And at least the industry super funds have performed better than the retail funds.
Very good point.
I think that's why it's escaped the scrutiny.
Yep.
But I don't think that should mean it escapes our boot.
Yeah.
We should still put the boot into them, because when we look at their actual returns, yes, they are better.
Yep.
And the top 10 best performing default super funds in Australia, I think most of them are retail super, maybe 9 out of 10 or something.
Industry
super funds, I apologise. Yep. Only 1 or 2 out of 10 is a
retail
fund.
Yep.
So yes, they have been performing better, but it's still this great swindle of, well, what could you be getting with your superannuation returns? Are your returns actually better than the market or another super fund? What's actually going on? So I guess my message for today is, don't get caught up in the big swindle.
Yeah.
It might look like a good performing super fund, but unless you look at the actual numbers of past performance and think about, well, what is the future performance going to be? It all comes down to the dollars and cents.
Yeah.
Because if you're just looking at the person on the other side of the counter in front of you who's wearing a pilot's uniform and says, I am an airline pilot and here is my check from the company that I work for, it could all be fake. So when an organization says, here is our marketing, here is our brand, this is what we promise you, it could all be fake.
Good advice, Louis. I'll be doing my number crunching when I look for a financial advisor. All right. Well, look, we'll leave it there for today. We're going to throw to our last segment for the day, which is You Can't Be Serious. Who has one for us? You can't be serious, man. You cannot
be serious. I'll kick it off. So over in Santa Rosa, which I believe is near Oakland. Well, let's call it
Oaktown.
Yeah, I believe it's near Oakland in California. So
by the bay,
a man who has a couple of dogs in has decided to put up a 6-foot fence so he could let his dogs run around in his backyard. No, in fact, it was his front yard. Now his house is on the corner of a street, so an intersecting street. So he's on the corner block, and he's put this 6-foot fence up. Now his nosy neighbor has complained to the city saying that the fence is too high and that it's a problem for drivers that are approaching the intersection being able to see what's coming through to the next intersection.
Okay.
Fair comment, but this guy got jacked because, you know, the cost of the fence initially was $9,000, and the city was threatening that if he doesn't lower the size of the fence down to a more reasonable size, a height of, say, 3 feet, that he would be fined $500 a day. Whoa. So what do you do if you're pissed off with your neighbour who's just got you into all of this trouble?
You let his dogs jump over there.
Well, you lower the fence and you build a nice little garden setting where you've got fake nude mannequins. And you leave a seat for your nosy neighbour to come and dine with us.
I love it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, well played.
Neighbourhood relationships.
Any more for any more?
Look, I need to relate this one. Given that it's the start of the AFL season, I heard during the week that an AFL legend, Gary Ablett Sr., he added to his goal-kicking tally this week, long after he retired.
Really?
Did he?
Yes. But he didn't do it physically. It was an error in the records.
Oh, really?
No.
So yeah, what had happened is apparently he played some games for Hawthorn. For those who didn't know, he played with Hawthorn before he went to Geelong. Only a few games, I think 4 games. And in one of those games, he kicked 2 goals, but the way the records were transferred over to the necessary archive people, it was only jotted down as 1. Someone was watching historical footage, happened to see him kick 2 goals. At the same time, looked at the stat sheet and said, oh, that's wrong.
You're kidding.
Contacted the archive people and the record's been updated.
Wow. How is that?
Yeah, quite bizarre.
But must be a real diehard Gary Ablett senior fan.
You must be, to be watching a game like that.
Why else are you watching that archive footage?
The hand of God.
So here we go. I'll give some details for anyone that wants to watch it. So his 4th league game, which was an 18-point win against Richmond when he was playing for Hawthorn in round 5, 1982. He was credited with 1 goal, 4, but footage of the game proves he actually slotted 2.
Wow.
Right. So 37 years later, it was rectified.
37.
And not Gary didn't actually even know. It was just a...
Eagle-eyed fan.
Eagle-eyed fan.
Wow.
Yep.
All right.
Now, something else that is not related to football... Have we all heard the song or the saying, what should we do with the drunken sailor?
Yes.
Perhaps. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Well, the answer to that question is now go search for them. The reason being, cool. 3 drunk Russian sailors were found stranded on an island off the Brit coast. Now, this happened because they left their ship in the middle of the night, taking the rubber boat from the ship to go to shore for a few drinks.
Oh,
at about 3:45 a.m, they decided, oh, we must have to head back. Couldn't find their way and just happened to find a nearby island to stumble on and have a sleep.
Oh, I love that. That'd be interesting people to party with.
Classic.
All right. Well, thank you so much, guys, for all your input today. I know it's the start of the football season and you guys are off to see Collingwood play tonight.
Collingwood win tonight.
Yes, Collingwood win tonight. It should be a good start. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And we'll speak to you all again next week.
Thanks, Steph.
Thank you.
Have a happy weekend.
You too.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes.
This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.